others we criticized. Everybody had the chance to speak. We kept asking, why do you need this? How does it compare to a top six modernization priority? Why do you need a new one? How much longer can you drive the old one? Does the war plan say we need that many? Why? 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 We learned a lot about the army. The machine, thoughtlessly, on autopilot, consumed billions of dollars buying equipment simply because it was on an organizational chart. Thousands and thousands of dump trucks, forklifts, and trailers. And now they were asking for new models, all to replace the current ones that often sat rusting, rarely moving in motor pools. Our wartime experiences showed we rarely used all this stuff. Forklifts, for example, were often provided by the host nation, or they could be leased. We needed to look at these types of options, not just buy more. I would often say, the Bradley fighting vehicle is decades old, and we've reached the end of its upgrading. If we have to fight the Russians in 10 years or the Chinese in 20, would you rather have new forklifts and dump trucks or a new fighting vehicle? We reduced Army watercraft by 50%, canceled programs for new rubber boats and cyber-proofed surveying instruments, scrutinized Army museums and institutes, and froze new hires for our civilian workforce. We spared few things outright. We went deep, we went broad, and we went hard. We also went after military construction, figuring out that there was really no prioritization there either. Everybody seemed to be log rolling, calculating who would be next to get a budget increase or project they wanted, instead of what the Army needed to prepare its soldiers or win the next fight. Several weeks, 500-plus programs, and over 50 hours of personal time later in night court resulted in us finding at least $25 billion in savings, with the accounting still ongoing. We had eliminated or reduced 186 programs to fund our modernization initiatives, as well as such things as expanded basic training, a new recruiting campaign, and a complete overhaul of our physical fitness program. The hard part now was selling it to Congress. To do so, I gave McCarthy the green light to go to the Hill weeks before the budget rollout to start briefing them. It was unconventional and actually not permitted by standard practice, but we needed to inform the chairman and ranking members before the administration delivered the budget to Capitol Hill. That way we could answer their questions up front, privately, quietly, before 186 program cuts dropped in members' laps. Giving them our numbers and rationale would also help them fend off the press, upset colleagues, angry constituents, corporate lobbyists, and others. By the time the budget arrived at the House and Senate on March 11, 2019, the final amount saved over 5 years would be $31 billion. Every single one of the top 31 programs bundled under our six new modernization priorities received the money it needed. It was all about implementing our own vision for the Army. Most lawmakers respected that. Enough of them would get behind our plans as well. At the end of the day, Congress supported all of our 186 proposed cuts and reductions except one. The major disappointment was our plan to delay the purchase of Block 2 CH-47 helicopters for 5 years, until we could determine whether we needed them, even though the current facts and data told us we really didn't. In our efforts to prepare the Army for high-intensity conflict against the Chinese or Russians, we needed a new type of heavy-lift aircraft. We needed one that could fly farther, faster, and with heavier loads, and which was less vulnerable to modern air defense systems. That wasn't the CH-47, in my view. Don't get me wrong, I had nothing against the CH-47 Chinook. It was a very capable aircraft. It was what carried other soldiers and me behind Iraqi lines in the opening days of the Operation Desert Storm ground offensive in 1991. However, like so many other Army systems, we didn't see it holding up well in the future. Moreover, we already had 10% more of them in the inventory than we needed. Rather than keep spending billions more on an aircraft we didn't need, we decided to put those dollars into developing new helicopters. A few lawmakers felt differently, regrettably. So much for putting our soldiers and readiness first. The importance of congressional support for our efforts was more than the dollars and cents facts that we were freeing up money for the future. It sent an important message to the Army that our efforts, our hard work, the tough decisions we were making would be rewarded. It was helpful in terms of purging bad habits from the system and working to adopt better ones. The Army would continue our night court proceedings into the fall, and then into 2019. By the spring of that year, only a few months before I would become Secretary of Defense, we canceled another 41 programs and delayed or reduced 39 more to find an additional $13.5 billion in savings. The good news was that we never found fraud or waste. These were good programs. We simply needed to put their dollars into higher priorities. With the budget relatively flat at around $178 billion, we knew that we had to keep digging deep or risk the future. Our efforts were paying off. As we rolled into 2019 with our modernization initiatives moving forward nicely, I wanted to make the upcoming year about replacing the clunky Army personnel system with one based on talent management. We needed to go from an up or out philosophy to a perform or out approach. This would be a major change for the Army, the personnel pillar of the Renaissance. But it was long overdue and much needed. It would go a long way toward advancing our credo of putting people first. Vice Chief of Staff Jim McConville was passionate about the issue of talent management, which made him a perfect battle buddy when it came to reforming the personnel system. Not only did McConville bring a warfighter's perspective to the task, but he was also a functional expert as the former head of Army personnel and as the father of adult children who were serving. Under McConville's and my direction, a talent management task force was formed to turn what the four of us often called an industrial-age personnel system into a digital one for the 21st century, and one that promised to do a far better job of meeting the needs of the soldier, the family, commanders, and the Army. We went about setting up a market-based, talent-focused model that gave commanders and soldiers, beginning with the officer corps, the buyers and sellers, respectively, more say in their careers, their timelines, and the assignments they took. Within the constraints of a military system where the needs of the Army still had to come first, there was no reason that we couldn't give people more say in their careers. Past studies and ongoing pilot projects demonstrated that a market-based system would work more efficiently and with higher rates of satisfaction than the current command-directed one. The system wasn't completely broken, but it could be a whole lot better. In a volunteer force, people vote with their feet, and we were often losing too many top performers. In 2018, soldiers didn't make decisions to stay or go based solely on their career. Now their duty location, their spouse's job prospects, and their children's schools were also factors. We needed to give our service members the opportunity to stay at one duty station longer than 3 years if they wanted to because, for example, their wife or husband had a great job, they loved the schools, the community was wonderful, or aging parents were nearby. Homesteading may make them less competitive than peers who were willing to move and experience more of the Army, but that's a decision they could make as adults and professionals. Leah and I moved 4 times between 1990 and 1995. It's not bad when it's just the two of you, an apartment's worth of household goods, and a young child, but it's really tough when you're asking your older kids to change schools 2 or 3 times as teenagers. And of course, Leah couldn't get a full-time job commensurate with her degree and work history. Companies knew she was married to an Army officer. They simply didn't want to invest the time in someone who likely had to leave in a couple of years. We needed to adjust our personnel system to these realities. By May 2019, the leadership team was speaking publicly about the Army Talent Alignment Process Program, which would allow officers to search and apply for jobs across the Army. They would post their resumes and any other information they felt relevant to the assignments they were seeking. Commanders, conversely, would be able to see applicants and make better choices about who served in their units. They could attract top talent by posting things such as their command philosophy, training regimen, and the expectations they had of their subordinates. We began the inaugural iteration of this program in the first half of 2019, and the initial feedback was very good. That summer, we also piloted a new multi-day approach to selecting battalion commanders based on the NFL's combine. Under this new system, selected officers underwent a series of cognitive, non-cognitive, and physical assessments, such as fitness tests, assessments of verbal and written communications skills, and a double-blind interview with a panel of senior officers. We knew the first major gateway to becoming a future commander and senior army leader began with battalion command. As such, picking this initial pool of leaders was critical to the future of the service. We had to get it right. You must select officers who not only will excel at the battalion level, but also have the potential to be a general officer who could perform at the four-star rung. This change turned out to be a dramatic and historic one that is already exceeding expectations. There were several other initiatives we were pursuing as well, such as giving service members the opportunity to take year-long unpaid sabbaticals without being penalized, and making it possible for soldiers to make seamless transitions between the regular Army, the National Guard, and the Army Reserve. I had made these switches over my 21-year career, and it was needlessly difficult. Building ease and flexibility into career management could go a long way toward keeping people in the service. All these things were good ideas, but the top issues for many families were spousal hiring and childcare. Military spouses were the most overqualified and underemployed group of people in the country, I felt. It was an unfortunate byproduct of an army system that moved people frequently, and sometimes to states and locales that didn't recognize their credentials, want the professional competition, or need their skills. It was a bad mix of things that worked against spouses and families. We went about approaching this problem by making professional license reciprocity a condition for installation investment decisions. Working with members of Congress on federal mandates or state-level assistance, and other initiatives. I also worked with my fellow service secretaries to write all 50 governors to inform them that family issues, such as the quality of local schools and license reciprocity for spouses, would be factors when our services evaluated future basing questions. We made some progress, but not nearly enough. It would take becoming Secretary of Defense to add more heft to this push, but even then, I didn't accomplish all that I had hoped. There were some obvious and simple solutions available, such as mandating through federal or state law that states must recognize a military spouse's professional credentials for up to 3 years when they arrive due to military orders, and creating a business tax incentive for hiring a military spouse. We couldn't seem to get much traction on either of these with lawmakers, though, which was frustrating, especially with so many elected officials talking the talk. Many states did recognize a military spouse's professional license, but not all. It was disappointing. One great story comes to mind, and it shows the tenacity and spirit of military spouses. In October 2019, while visiting Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, Leah met a woman named Bree McKinnon at a spouse luncheon. Bree had earned a teaching degree in special education in Washington State, but said Ohio made it almost impossible for her to get a job, even though she was credentialed and positions were open. Unwilling to give in, Bree took up the fight. After 2 years of meetings, constant travel, and testimony, she persuaded state lawmakers to draft, approve, and deliver a military spouse reciprocity law to the governor's desk, which he signed in early 2020. Bree's leadership and tenacity made all the difference for countless numbers of military spouses in Ohio. However, I couldn't expect our spouses to lead the charge, nor could I blame local, state, and federal governments for all our challenges. Even on our own installations, the civilian hiring process was long and complicated. On one of my first overseas visits as Secretary of the Army, I did a town hall meeting with families at Camp Humphreys in South Korea. The session was held in the chapel, an interesting location once the discussion broke down into tough talk from spouses seated in one set of pews, directed at the installation staff, seated in another. The spouses were rightly angry about a hiring process that took over 130 days on average to get someone working. Many on the installation staff thought that was quick, but it was terrible. The Army needed to get the process down to no more than 45 days. Who can wait more than 4 months to take a job? However, these timelines were the average across the service. So I started a very tedious process month after month, going through every step of the hiring system to cut out wasted time. Whether it was background checks, drug tests, or multiple review boards, you name it, we looked at it. We reduced it to under 90 days in the Army, and even that was excessively long. The extended hiring process made it difficult to tackle the biggest issue for many families: childcare. Some people thought we needed more on-base facilities, but that wasn't the main issue. When you looked at locations with long wait periods, months, such as the Washington, D.C. area or Hawaii, the first problem that jumped out was the fact that some childcare facilities were only 70% or so filled. The 30% vacancy rate was due to a lack of childcare providers, and that was because the civilian hiring system was so slow. The reforms we put in place, like a centralized background check process and getting direct hiring authority, began fixing this. Addressing the supply side of the equation could take us only so far in the near term. We also had to look at the demand side. Reducing bureaucracy and timelines became my focus for my 19 months as Army Secretary. I kept with it as Secretary of Defense, too. The demand on the DoD childcare system was too great to accommodate the needs of our service members under a first-come, first-served basis. Too often, junior enlisted personnel couldn't get on-base childcare because the children of DoD civilian workers filled many of the slots. So I directed that military children take priority over the children of DoD civilian employees. Prioritizing military children rankled a good many civilian employees, but our first obligation had to be to our service members, especially our junior enlisted. We had to put our service members first. Many lived on base, which made driving back and forth off base twice a day to drop off and pick up their kids a hassle, and sometimes a hindrance to the service member's work schedule. It could be a round trip of more than 30 minutes each time. Second, most civilians employed by the DoD either grew up in the area where they worked or rarely moved, so they had established friend and family networks to help them out. Military personnel who were coming and going every 3 years or less didn't have this advantage. And finally, some of our service members worked unusual hours, including getting up early in the morning for physical training, which made having access to the on-base child care center to accommodate these things important to their work performance. Mission accomplished for me would have been having sufficient on-base child care for those service members seeking it, plus the ability to do hourly care, and finally, the option to have 24/7 services for those bases and career fields that needed that type of flexibility. The same was true for improving the Exceptional Family Member Program, a system by which a service member with a child in need of specialty care or medical attention would get easier access to both. Moreover, the family's needs would be taken into far greater account when assigning the service member to a new post. Each of these programs worked well at different installations around the U.S. military, so I knew what was possible. We needed to adopt, adapt, and standardize them across the armed forces. We had settled on a plan for hourly child care in the fall of 2020. I wish we could have implemented this plan and the other things on my watch. Some changes like this were hard for obvious reasons, but others seemed unnecessarily difficult. During my visit to Hawaii in August 2020, Leah learned that local commissaries and post-base exchanges did not allow patrons to wear fitness clothes, like gym shorts and yoga pants, inside the store. Needless to say, spouses were quite upset. After all, this wasn't the 1950s. We heard stories of military wives returning from a fitness class who had to drive all the way home to change before going back out to pick up a gallon of milk or pump gas at the exchange. Another spouse recounted a story of how a Marine denied a mom and her 7-year-old boy from entering the commissary because the child was wearing workout clothes. This was ridiculous. We asked the families to put up with short-notice moves, long deployments, missed holidays, and all of the other rigors of military life. Why make anything else more difficult than necessary? I came back from the Hawaii visit and asked my personnel and readiness office to draft a memo authorizing the wear of fitness clothes to commissaries and exchanges on all bases, provided they were clean, modest, and serviceable. They then sent the memo around to other OSD and service offices for coordination and comment. To my surprise, none of the armed services supported the change. They argued it was their business. "Okay," I said. "If it's your business, then go ahead and change it so that I don't have to." We waited weeks to see movement. Nothing. My staff told me the uniformed leaders are concerned about good order and discipline of their service members. I understand, sort of. But the spouses and children didn't join the military, so why not let them wear fitness clothes? Silence. We made one final adjustment to the memo, then, that gave the service secretaries the authority to waive the relaxed attire standards for military personnel. Still, no one approved. I had had enough. In October, I decided to send out my own directive with no support whatsoever from the services. Many considered this a trivial matter for a Secretary of Defense to concern himself with, but it was the right thing to do for our families, and an important signal to send to our leaders. If we were going to talk the talk about taking care of families, so to speak, then we needed to walk the walk. In addition, I was confident that good order and discipline would survive in the U.S. military. The lesson of this story is that even the simplest things at the Pentagon are difficult to change. Sometimes you have to just do it. I don't know whether any other Army secretary or defense secretary spent as much time on family issues, but having lived it, heard it, and committed to take it on, I couldn't let the issue go. I can only hope we made a difference for some military families, especially the spouses. Aside from serving in an infantry battalion, nowhere else did I have more professional satisfaction than my time as Secretary of the Army. As I said before, it was a great opportunity and experience. Leah and I really enjoyed being back and working with a wonderful group of uniformed and civilian professionals, while also being able to accomplish a good deal in the time we had. I went to work every day as if it was my last, and every day we moved the ball farther down the field. I was blessed to have Ryan McCarthy, General Mark Milley, General Jim McConville, SMA Dan Daly, and many others on the team with me. After 19 months of hard work together, I felt we had launched a true Army renaissance that would resonate and endure long after we left. We were well on our way toward restoring the service back to the war-fighting posture it needed to be in if we were to fully realize George Washington's and Ronald Reagan's view that the best way to preserve peace is by being ready to fight and win the war. In time, I would come to realize that my experiences in the Pentagon as Secretary of the Army and the relationships I had built both there and beyond with General Milley, the OSD and joint staffs, combatant commanders, the National Guard, members of Congress, international leaders, and others would serve me well in the challenging times ahead as the 27th Secretary of Defense. Chapter 3. War with Iran begins in Iraq. The United States and Iran were one misstep away from open conflict. Planes, drones, and ships from both countries' air forces and navies traversed the contentious waters of the Persian Gulf, on it, beneath it, and above it. Proxy forces funded and directed by Tehran spread mischief throughout the region, while Washington and its allies worked their own shadow war to blunt and counter these malign actions. It was hard to believe we might find ourselves in another Middle East war. President Trump appointed me acting Secretary of Defense on June 24, 2019, smack dab in the middle of this evolving milieu. America's most serious set of confrontations, friction, and heated rhetoric with Iran in decades. I was not the person expected to take the job of Defense Secretary. Although I had been serving as the Secretary of the Army, one of the three service secretaries at the DOD, Trump had selected Patrick Shanahan, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, months earlier. Pat was a tall, blonde, 30-year veteran of the Boeing Company, where he had led many of its trademark programs. He was a sharp leader and capable engineer with a good sense of humor. I had known Pat before he arrived at the Pentagon and liked him. His strong business skills were a good complement to what former Marine General Jim Mattis brought to his role as Secretary of Defense. Secretary Mattis spent a lot of time on the road during his tenure, which I suspected was his strategy to avoid Trump and whatever requests might be made of him. This left Pat responsible for the occasional cabinet meetings and other engagements with the president. As such, a rapport developed between Shanahan and Trump. So when Mattis resigned in late December 2018, Pat was the natural successor as deputy, and he became the acting Secretary of Defense on January 1, 2019. In May, 4 months later, Trump announced that Shanahan would become the next Secretary of Defense. There was some skepticism on Capitol Hill about Pat, but most expected his eventual confirmation. Not long after that, however, scrutiny into his personal life involving his ex-wife and children brought to light a dark period that prompted him to step aside. I felt bad for Pat. He had put his heart and soul into the job and was getting things done. But the beast that was Washington, D.C. was chewing him up, much like it did so many other people. It was one thing to dig into a nominee's past, but doing so in a way that harms a person's family was over the top. Nobody deserves that. I was at an Army Senior Leader Conference in D.C. on Tuesday, June 18th, when an aide pulled me from a meeting and told me the president wanted to speak with me. Although I was occupying the third highest position at the Pentagon, my responsibility was the training, manning, and equipping of the U.S. Army. I did not interact with the president often. That was the Secretary of Defense's role. However, Trump and I had met and talked a few times in the past. At a tank plant in Ohio, and at a dignified transfer of a fallen soldier at Dover Air Force Base, which is where service members killed abroad in combat are welcomed home, back to U.S. soil, by their comrades, senior officials, and grieving families. I also met the president at the White House on a few occasions, and during events like the Army-Navy football game. He also saw me do television interviews a couple of times and called to congratulate and tell me I did a great job on one of them. So over time, we had developed an easy rapport. During our conversations, he would ask for my views on any number of issues, most outside my purview as Secretary of the Army. Do you think we should be in Iraq? Tell me about your thoughts on Afghanistan. How is the Southwest border wall coming along? What do you think of Pat Shanahan? General Mark Milley? What about China? How do you feel about NATO? My previous government and private sector jobs gave me a broad and deep background in foreign policy and national security, so I felt confident offering up my views and perspectives. Back then, I found the president easy to speak with, curious, and willing to listen. My experience at the time was far different from the caricatures in the press. Then again, my interactions at that point were limited. As I walked to another room to take the call, news outlets reported that Shanahan was stepping down. Uh-oh. I could put two and two together. We knew Pat's nomination was wobbly, and there was speculation that I was next in the queue, but that was all it was. Speculation. I was standing in a large, empty classroom when the call came in from the White House. I paced back and forth with nervous energy, like a soldier on guard duty, the phone pressed to my ear, anticipating the conversation I would soon have. The phone line briefly cackled, and as always happens before the president gets on the line, a voice formally announced, "Mr. Secretary, the president." It was so serious and formal that you couldn't help but be awed by the moment. President Trump jumped on the line and immediately said, "Hello, Mark, how are you?" drawing out the words a little longer than usual. "Fine, Mr. President," I responded. "How are you, sir?" He was on speakerphone. I could hear the faint voices of others in the background. The president was in an upbeat mood and playing to the moment. We exchanged a few other niceties, and then he went to the point of the call. Trump said that Pat Shanahan is withdrawing from the nomination, and added that it's a shame what he is going through. It's terrible, he said. So unfair. Pat is a good man. I agreed as I listened intently and gazed at the floor in front of me. The volume and pitch of his voice quickly changed again. You could feel the energy in the line as he began, speaking not just to me, but also to everyone gathered in the Oval Office. Without pausing as he spoke loudly into the phone, the president said, "Mark, I want you to become my Secretary of Defense. I got a whole room full of people here who think you will do a great job. So do I. What do you say?" I stopped my pacing. I was now standing in this stark, white room with empty work tables all about, the phone pressed into my right ear. It was all very quiet and lonely as his words came through the line. Although I had known this question was coming, I was still humbled and taken aback, aware of the history of the moment. Here I was, a young man from southwest Pennsylvania who left home at 18 to attend West Point and become an Army officer, finding myself 37 years later with the President of the United States asking me to become the nation's next Secretary of Defense. I would be stepping into the job my hometown hero, George C. Marshall, assumed in September 1950, and doing so as one of the youngest secretaries in many years. The only answer I could give was, "Yes, Mr. President," followed by, "It would be an honor and privilege to serve my country as Secretary of Defense." With that, Trump thanked and congratulated me. My words slightly echoed in the empty classroom. Trump then said, "Let's meet very soon to talk. I'm excited to have you on board. You'll do great." "Thanks, Mr. President. I look forward to it," I replied. And with a quick, "Okay, great, see you later," Trump ended the call. I started pacing again, thinking about all the things I needed to start doing. There was no formal interview, per se, but that was not unusual. All presidents manage these things a little differently, depending on whether they know the person, the recommendations of their closest advisors, the circumstances at the moment, and other factors. Unlike many of my predecessors, I was already in the administration, serving as Secretary of the Army. I had a track record in the executive branch and with Congress, knew many who were close to the president, and even had a relationship with first daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner. Moreover, the president and I had talked several times in the past, both in person and on the phone, so he knew where I stood on a variety of issues, including ones where we disagreed, such as NATO. Yet because those conversations were often one-sided, I didn't know or fully appreciate his views on several matters that would become friction points between us. I would have, however, a couple of weeks on the job before the president formally nominated me to talk further, share my views on other issues, and to get his agreement regarding my style of work and access to him. I immediately called my wife, Leah, to share the news. We both couldn't believe how far we had traveled together. From two kids on a blind date in Nashville in 1988, to Washington, D.C., three children, and 30 years of marriage, she was the best person to share that journey with, and Lord knows I would need her by my side in the days ahead. After my calls, I gathered my immediate team in the classroom and told them we had to get back to the Pentagon. I spoke privately with General Milley, the Army Chief of Staff and my right hand, for a few minutes too. The President had already selected him to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was reassuring for both of us to know that we would be working alongside someone that we knew and respected. "Battle buddies again," we'd say. He congratulated me, spoke briefly about how we would both be playing at a much higher level now, with far more scrutiny, and then joked about buckling up for a crazy ride ahead. How prescient. I quickly headed back to the Pentagon to meet with Shanahan, taking calls from National Security Advisor John Bolton and others as we sped toward Arlington. Pat graciously congratulated me as I entered the building, saying, "You'll do great," and offering to do everything he could in the short time we had to get me up to speed. With the withdrawal of his name as Secretary of Defense, Pat also decided to resign as Deputy Secretary of Defense. He seemed relieved. I was happy for him in that regard. Once Pat stepped down, I would become the acting Secretary of Defense, given that the Secretary of the Army is next up in the line of succession. I would be taking over before formal Senate confirmation. To ensure the transfer of power was as orderly, legal, and low risk as possible, we picked Sunday, June 23rd at midnight as the handover point. I would be responsible after that. Before then, I would shadow Shanahan in his daily duties, keeping my eyes and ears open and my thoughts to myself. After all, there is only one Secretary of Defense at a time, and I didn't want to confuse the chain of command or my future colleagues by commenting on matters while Pat was still in charge. This was especially important given the growing tensions between the United States and Iran and the crash course I would soon get on the rigors of the job and the unpredictability of the president. America's relationship with Iran is a long and sordid one. Formal relations between the two countries dates back to the mid-19th century. Interactions were generally positive through the end of World War II. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the Shah, king of Iran, who came to power in 1941, was strongly pro-American. As the Cold War emerged, this was important to the United States, given Iran's strategic location in the Persian Gulf and its long border with the Soviet Union. In 1953, Iranian sentiment toward America turned after the United States and the United Kingdom organized a coup that overthrew the government of Mohammad Mossadegh, the popular prime minister. Growing tensions between him and the United Kingdom were empowering the Communist Party in the country, which risked pushing Iran into the Soviet orbit. This prompted Mossadegh's removal. Pahlavi became more authoritarian over time and undertook initiatives to modernize Iran that created tensions with conservative groups. By the late 1970s, large anti-Shah demonstrations were common. In early 1979, Iranian hardliners overthrew Pahlavi and replaced him with the popular Ayatollah Khomeini, who established the Islamic Republic. In less than a year, an anti-Western theocracy had replaced a pro-American monarchy in a critical part of the world. Iranians, angered by the United States' long-standing support for the Shah, seized the U.S. embassy and took dozens of Americans hostage in November 1979. The Iranians held 52 of them captive for 444 days. The United States and Iran have had no formal relations since then. Rather, conflict has marked the relationship over the last 40 years, most notably the 1983 car bomb attack that killed 241 U.S. service members in their Beirut barracks. The U.S. embassy in Lebanon had been bombed a few months earlier by Hezbollah, a militant Shia group founded by Iran, leaving 17 Americans dead. And in 1988, the USS Vincennes accidentally shot down an Iranian airliner, killing 290 passengers and crew. Limited naval actions by the United States against Iran in the Gulf marked the late 1980s. The 1990s saw the Clinton administration embargo the country, with Congress piling on additional sanctions. In late 2002, the United States accused Iran of pursuing nuclear weapons work, a charge buttressed by a UN assessment months later that said Tehran failed to report certain nuclear materials and activities that are associated with a bomb-making program. Throughout the 2000s, Iran provided Iraqi militias with weapons, training, and equipment to support their insurgency against the United States. Such was the state of play between Tehran and Washington as the Trump administration came to power in January 2017. Even before the election, Trump repeatedly vowed to extricate the United States from the 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. He called the 2015 pact a horrible deal and the worst ever negotiated. Many Republicans in Congress agreed, as did Israel and several Gulf Arab states. Critics said the agreement threatened the security of the United States, never really ended the regime's nuclear efforts, and gave Tehran cover to advance a covert nuclear program. They added that the deal was not sufficiently verifiable and didn't provide adequate access to Iranian nuclear sites for international inspectors. The Iran nuclear deal was not a good one. It gave away too much up front in terms of unfreezing their funds and providing sanctions relief, without getting nearly enough when it came to the scope of the agreement, its duration, and the verification mechanisms. Trump was correct that the Iranian regime couldn't be trusted, which is why these shortcomings made the deal so misbegotten. In addition to proscribing their nuclear weapon development efforts, Trump also stressed the importance of dealing with their ballistic missiles and sponsorship of terrorism throughout the region, both of which threatened U.S. forces in the Middle East and partners like Israel and Kuwait. While the nuclear concern was a legitimate and existential one for neighboring countries, it was still a future proposition. Iranian ballistic missiles and Tehran's support for terrorist groups were serious issues the United States and our partners faced daily. The agreement with Iran should have covered all these things. I assume the Obama administration believed the nuclear part of the deal, even with its shortcomings, was the best they could get from Tehran. But was it? And why wasn't more effort made to get the Israelis, Saudis, Emiratis, and others in the region on board? Before finally exiting the agreement in 2018, President Trump said, It is clear to me that we cannot prevent an Iranian nuclear bomb under the decaying and rotten structure of the current agreement, adding that the Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. At the same time, the White House imposed a broad range of sanctions on Tehran. If I had been in the cabinet prior to Trump's exit from the Iran deal in 2018, I would have recommended we first try to handle the pact as a treaty and send it to the Senate for the chamber's advice and consent. In addition to being the proper way of addressing an agreement of this importance, such a strategy would have better exposed the deal's weaknesses and fundamental lack of support. After all, it was doubtful the nuclear deal could get a majority of votes in the Senate, let alone the two-thirds required for approval. The Senate's rejection of the 2015 deal would have set the stage to draft an improved version of the agreement, working hand in glove with Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. Once completed, we could have reached out to our Gulf partners and European allies to further refine the plan and forge a new consensus. Trump instead left the agreement and launched a maximum pressure campaign that imposed tough economic sanctions aimed at strong-arming Iran back to the negotiating table. The administration wanted to conclude a new deal that would address the weak points in the original pact. GOP allies in Congress and America's partners in the Middle East praised the president's move. Many Democrats in Congress and the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, three of the agreement's co-signers, opposed it. Their continued support for the 2015 deal likely incentivized Iran not to reopen the troubled agreement. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and I publicly said on many occasions that Washington was willing to sit down with the Iranians and talk without precondition. I never heard from Tehran or our allies, and I don't believe Pompeo did either. Realistically, this game plan would always be an uphill slog as long as the existing agreement still enjoyed some U.S. domestic and international support. As such, I concluded the path we were on could well result in a military confrontation. Nonetheless, the maximum pressure campaign certainly had an impact on Iran's military programs and support to foreign proxies, because it put a squeeze on that country's economy and cash reserves. Funding for their armed forces took a hit, as did their support for some external groups involved in terrorism. However, unilateral U.S. pressure was unlikely to bring Tehran back to the negotiating table anytime soon. With the Europeans on their side, and the possibility that Trump could be a one-term president, Iran was willing to bear the pain and simply hold on. They hoped a new administration in 2021 would return to the old, bad deal. It was still only 2019, however, and U.S.-Iranian relations were now at another historic low. In April, the State Department labeled the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, a foreign terrorist organization for its longstanding support of extremist groups throughout the region. The IRGC is a unique branch of the Iranian armed forces responsible for safeguarding the country's political system while also coordinating and supporting Iran's external operations. The IRGC is also a powerful player in Iran, with activities and influence throughout the country's economic, political, and social structure. Its leaders often have access to the highest levels of the government. Washington also threatened that month to sanction countries that continued to purchase oil from Iran, putting further pressure on Tehran's stressed economy. Weeks later, the United States deployed B-52 bombers and a carrier strike group to the Middle East amid concern that Iran was planning some type of regional offensive. That same week, Tehran declared it would be reducing its commitments under the nuclear deal. Tensions were escalating quickly in the Persian Gulf. Never one to undersell his intentions, President Trump warned on May 19th that conflict would be the official end of Iran. On that same day, militia groups aligned with and funded by Tehran fired rockets at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Two commercial tankers were attacked in the Gulf of Oman on June 13th. Secretary of State Pompeo declared that Iran was responsible, a charge they denied. A few days later, the president of Iran said his country would increase uranium enrichment if other countries failed to protect it from punitive U.S. economic measures. That same day, Trump placed additional sanctions on Iran's economy, and the Pentagon confirmed that 1,000 more troops would deploy to the region for defensive purposes following the attack on the oil tankers. And on the evening of June 20th, 2 days after the president asked me to be Secretary of Defense, Iran shot down a U.S. Air Force Global Hawk, a $200 million unmanned aircraft that was flying a surveillance mission in international airspace over the Strait of Hormuz. Trump's national security team, Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, Pat Shanahan, Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joseph Dunford, and I met over breakfast on the morning of the 21st to discuss options and develop a recommendation to present the president. I wasn't completely new to the group. I had known and worked with John Bolton since our days together in the George W. Bush administration. With graying hair and his telltale bushy white mustache, John was a force of nature in D.C., having established himself over many years as an attorney, diplomat, political commentator, and foreign policy hawk. John was a national security expert who was blunt, principled, and unyielding. He was a good fit for the National Security Advisor role. Mike Pompeo and I shared the common background of being in the same West Point class of 1986. We hadn't known each other at the academy, but we had dozens of mutual friends. Mike served in a cavalry unit in Germany upon graduation. He earned a law degree from Harvard and practiced in D.C. after leaving the Army. He then tried his hand in business back home in Wichita. I really befriended Mike and his wife Susan when he arrived in Washington as a freshman Republican congressman from Kansas in 2011. With salt-and-pepper hair and a stocky build, Mike was a conservative, a foreign policy hawk, and a man of deep faith, and he had a wry sense of humor to boot. General Joe Dunford was your classic Marine, tall and fit, with a close haircut. Dunford grew up in Boston, attended St. Michael's College in Vermont, and commissioned into the Corps the same year he graduated college. From there, he commanded at every level and led a regimental combat team during the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He later commanded the International Security Assistance Force and U.S. forces in Afghanistan in 2013, after which he became Commandant of the Marine Corps in 2014. Less than a year later, in 2015, President Obama selected him as the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the nation's highest military position. Dunford and I had become acquainted when I was Army Secretary. He was very helpful then, and even more so as I took on the role as Secretary of Defense. He spoke softly and wielded a deft hand when it came to doing his job and managing all the personalities in his orbit, from the president to the Joint Chiefs to everyone else around him. I always found his advice to be wise, candid, and insightful, and I relied on him a good deal. Everyone agreed on the importance of responding firmly to the unwarranted attack, and all felt it was essential that the National Security Team bring the president a unanimous recommendation. Bolton and Pompeo pushed for a very strong response. Shanahan and Dunford weighed in from the other side. The group eventually agreed, as the president himself later announced publicly, to strike three targets and take some additional measures. I remained silent out of deference to Pat, but privately felt the final action agreed to was still disproportionate. We could send the same message to Tehran with fewer casualties on their side. High losses could lead us to tit-for-tat escalatory actions, and who knew where that would take us? A National Security Council, NSC, meeting, which meant the president would attend with his appropriate cabinet members and top advisors, convened later that morning at 11 in the White House Situation Room. Bolton opened the session by discussing its purpose and presenting the unified recommendation of the three principles. Shanahan offered a few preliminary comments before turning the substance of the discussion over to Dunford. The general began by restating some of the overarching policy goals that had been agreed to in the past, followed by the purpose of any military response, and then walking the president through the various options, pausing to elaborate on the one recommended by the team. The room full of advisors was silent as he spoke. Shanahan sat closest to the president, to his left, followed by me, and then the chairman. Dunford had a very calm, steady, and low-key demeanor, locking eyes with the president as he spoke. He did his best to present the case and keep the president focused as Trump bounced from question to question. As he often did, Trump would interject with specific questions about the operation, such as, "How many planes will you use?" or "What is the economic cost of the damage that will be done?" He also piped up about our forces in Syria, looking at Dunford and Shanahan and directing both to get them out. This issue would come up repeatedly over the next several months. General Dunford gently steered Trump back to the issue at hand and made clear that, while the timing would limit casualties, we should expect that Iranians will be killed. He added that it was possible some Russians could be killed or injured as well. The chairman and Trump went back and forth on how we would know there would be Iranian losses or not. The president didn't seem overly concerned as much as he was curious. None of the lawyers in the room raised any questions either. Dunford put some other options out there that didn't involve killing people, but Trump wanted a very tough response. He kept saying, "We need to hit them hard. We need to make them pay." Trump then fixated on the cost of the U.S. drone, why it was so expensive, what its capabilities were, and so on. He wanted to strike something of more value, like an accountant keeping the books. Dollars were the metric, it seemed, more than the message we were trying to send or the policy outcome we wanted to achieve. However, when it comes to retaliatory attacks, the aim isn't to run up the score. That could get you into a worse situation. Rather, you want to signal determination and keep upping the ante until the other side folds. Trump approved the recommended strikes nonetheless, and without hesitation. As we all began shuffling out of the cramped room, the president was upbeat and confident. Groups of two or three folks gathered and remained behind to discuss specific items. You could feel the energy. We all knew that the contest with Iran was entering a new phase. The attack would begin later that day, after dinner in D.C. I joined Shanahan, Dunford, and others in the Secretary of Defense's office around then. General Dunford had just begun speaking with Trump on the secure phone when I entered. He was discussing estimated casualty numbers with the president as Shanahan listened in. The DOD legal office had apparently provided a casualty estimate to the NSC that said up to 150 people could be killed in the attacks. This report then made its way to the president. Technically, that number was correct. Up to 150 people could be killed. Dunford did his best to reassure Trump that the casualties would be less than that. He pointed out, for example, that we will hit the targets at night, Mr. President, after most of the people have gone home for the day. Dunford had been down this road before, though, with the earlier strikes on Syria coming to mind, and knew where this was heading. The irony of the discussion wasn't lost on us, either. 7 or so hours earlier, Trump seemed to be pressing for more aggressive action. Now here we were, minutes before the go-no-go call needed to be made, and the president was waffling. "I don't know, General," he said. 150 is a lot of people. They shoot down an unmanned plane and we kill 150? It doesn't seem right." Trump's unease and skepticism were evident in his voice. I could envision him sitting there with his arms folded, the left side of his face tightened up in a cynical look, frowning and shaking his head. To his credit, Dunford was quick to add, in his steady voice, "Mr. President, if you're not comfortable with the plan, then you shouldn't approve it." He was right about that, of course. While General Dunford and the president spoke, the rest of us in the room were quietly asking one another about this legal assessment. Who had seen it? What exactly did it say, and so forth? No one had. Amazing. Pat Shanahan, slightly pale and bleary-eyed from fatigue, turned, looked at me with a half-smile, and slowly shook his head. I couldn't tell whether he meant the mission was canceled, or he was simply sharing, with me, the new guy, his seeming frustration with what was a routinely haphazard decision-making process. I would learn over time that it was the latter. The military's practical estimates, based on years of experience and insight, focused on what was likely to occur. This was different from the legal assessment, which listed the ranges of what could occur that made its way to the president. Dunford was doing his best to make the case for action. It was an unexpected position to be in for someone who, Trump unfairly alleged to others in the past, wasn't aggressive enough. Bolton jumped in as well, working to counter the president's repeated concerns about body bags of Iranians being beamed all over television. It didn't matter, though. With the 150 casualties number locking in the president's mind, he was getting cold feet. Pompeo, who was now on the line, pushed back, pressing for the operation's approval. He came in forcefully behind Dunford's best case. You could hear the growing frustration in Mike's voice as the small group of us at the Pentagon stood around the secure phone on Shanahan's desk to hear the conversation. Pompeo spoke quickly, his pace quickening, pressing that, "We need to respond, Mr. President." He put forward his best arguments one after another, which practically devolved into pleas to do something. It didn't matter at this point. Trump's mind was decided. He rationalized that we could always strike later. The president canceled the attack. I thought later about these first 48 hours and the lessons I could take from them. I lauded Bolton for pulling the team together, getting us all behind one recommendation, and then presenting a unified front to the president. That was good and needed to continue. My sense, too, was that he and Pompeo were more willing to use military force against Iran than the Pentagon. Most troubling for me, however, was how to read the president. In the morning, he was gung-ho to hit Iran, and to do so harder than anyone had recommended. But less than 12 hours later, he completely reversed his position. Is this, I wondered, how things often played out? The president was right to consider proportionality, and maybe the team should have spoken more loudly about it at the 11 a.m. meeting. General Dunford, though, did a really good job with this. That said, I was personally concerned that even a couple of dozen Iranians killed was too many when responding to the shoot-down of an unmanned drone. So in the end, I was fine with calling off the specific mission. However, we still had a message of resolve that we needed to send Tehran, and we needed to restore deterrence. Failing to do both would likely guarantee more Iranian bad behavior as they continued to push and test us. Rather than calling off the strikes and walking away from the incident, we should have hit some other targets that would have achieved our purposes without any killed. But we didn't, and history moved on, arguably setting us up for more trouble ahead. Over the weekend leading up to the Sunday evening handover with Shanahan, it was clear that we could soon be back in the Situation Room presenting military options again for the Commander-in-Chief to consider. The President would likely look to me for a recommendation if that happened. I was determined to make one even if I wasn't asked. Given the weighty issues of war and peace that I could soon face, I wanted to make sure that my thought process was principled, disciplined, and thorough. Prior to my confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee weeks later, the committee required me to answer hundreds of advance policy questions. One of them dealt with the use of military force and the factors I would consider in making recommendations to the president. My reflection that weekend would evolve into the following response I provided the Senate. In evaluating whether the use of military force is appropriate, I would consider a variety of factors, but principally the threat to the United States, including its imminence, the nature of the U.S. interest at issue and its importance, whether non-military means have been considered and are being integrated into any proposed response, whether we would have a clear and achievable objective for using force, the likely risks, costs, and consequences of the operation, whether the proposed action is appropriate and proportional, the views of the Congress, the willingness of foreign partners to support the action, and the legal basis in domestic and international law. I would carry this statement, the 9 considerations for the use of military force, around with me during the nearly 18 months I served as Secretary of Defense, and I would refer to it when the situation demanded. I didn't view it as a mechanical checklist, but as a guide to aid my thinking and help formulate my recommendations. After all, every situation is unique and requires judgment and discernment. I just wanted to make sure I kept faith with the Department, the Congress, the American people, and myself. The Sunday midnight transition with Shanahan went off without incident. The next morning, I started early as the acting Secretary of Defense, beginning with an 8 a.m. meeting with my civilian leaders, the service chiefs, and the combatant commanders. The purpose of this session was to introduce myself in this new role, discuss my leadership style and priorities, and to lay out my expectations of the command team. I had already drafted an initial message to the department, which my front office would send out to everyone in the DOD that morning, but I wanted to elaborate on some of the main points in that note for those gathered. I made clear that carrying out the National Defense Strategy, NDS, the Pentagon's plan to implement the President's National Security Strategy and modernize the U.S. Armed Forces, was my top priority, with our goal being able to fight and win our nation's wars should deterrence fail. My focus was on China, then Russia, in that order. I also stated what I would say in my formal message, that I place great importance on a commitment by all, especially leaders, to those values and behaviors that represent the best of the military profession and mark the character and integrity of the armed forces that the American people admire. I added that we all must stay focused on the mission and remain steadfast in your pursuit of excellence. And I finished by urging everyone to always strive to do the right thing, a saying that would become my touch phrase, along with the more practical, follow established process and precedent, in the difficult times ahead that were not yet known to me. On July 1, 2019, upon my return from a NATO meeting in Brussels, I held a 90-minute secure call with U.S. Central Command, the 4-star geographic command responsible for all operations in the Middle East. I wanted to discuss Operation Sentinel, an initiative to ensure freedom of navigation and commerce, important long-standing principles of U.S. foreign policy, in the Persian Gulf in light of recent actions by Iran to threaten commercial shipping. I would pause with concern later in my tenure when others in the administration pressed, without regard to these well-established tenets of U.S. foreign policy, to interdict Iranian or Venezuelan ships arbitrarily on the high seas. General Frank McKenzie, the capable CENTCOM commander, briefed the plan. McKenzie was from Alabama, attended college at the Citadel, and commissioned into the Marine Corps in 1979. He was an infantry officer who commanded at multiple levels, with deployments to both Iraq and Afghanistan. McKenzie served a few tours in the Pentagon, with his last being as director of the Joint Staff beginning in July 2017, which is where I first met him. He took the helm of U.S. Central Command in March 2019. I liked McKenzie. He was an able leader with a steady hand who operated in a very complex and demanding theater. At any one time, he had to deal with Shia militia forces attacking us in Iraq, a potential ISIS resurgence in Syria, Taliban operations in Afghanistan, and the ongoing confrontations with Iran from Yemen all the way to Lebanon. On top of all that, he also had to deal with me constantly pressing him to reshape the theater for the future while looking for ways to free up forces that I could retask to deal with China. He had a tough job, but handled it well. McKenzie's basic concept for Operation Sentinel was to increase maritime and overhead surveillance at both ends of the Strait of Hormuz, and then farther up into the Gulf as well. We would do this with a combination of U.S. naval vessels, manned aircraft, and unmanned surveillance drones. I believed if we could deter Iranian bad behavior in the first place, we could avoid an accident, provocation, or intentional act that could lead to real conflict. I spoke with Pompeo during our weekly call and updated him on our plans to activate Operation Sentinel. The key now was getting partners to join us. Defense was working this angle, but we really needed state to push it hard, which Mike agreed to do. We would all have a tough job, though, with the French working quietly behind the scenes against us to keep our other European partners from joining, concerned that doing so would anger the Iranians. I also shared with Pompeo some of my recent discussions in Brussels regarding Afghanistan and the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, INF, treaty. We also talked about our continuing challenges with Turkey, especially their purchase of the Russian S-400 air defense system. Afghanistan and Turkey would be tough, enduring issues for us during my nearly 18 months in office. According to the U.S. Department of State, the INF Treaty was a 1987 agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union that eliminated both countries' ground-launched ballistic and cruise missiles with ranges of between 500 and 5,500 kilometers, and their associated launchers, support structures, and equipment within 3 years after the treaty entered into force in 1988. Mike and I developed a good working relationship early on, and that approach resonated throughout both departments. Some would say it was one of the most positive eras of collaboration between state and defense. It was certainly true compared to my time at the DoD from 2002 through 2004, When Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Colin Powell clashed on a routine basis, like Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz before them in the Reagan years. Mike and I built our interactions on not only our personal friendship, but also the similar approaches we often took when it came to dealing with the issues in our respective portfolios. Our close collaboration occasionally caused concern among some at times, and it was the subject of a misinformed news story or two, but we would often get a good laugh out of these. Mike would hear from folks on his side complain that he was yielding too much to Esper and DOD. And I would hear the opposite from people who followed defense matters. To me, that meant we had the relationship about right. By August, the national security team's principal focus shifted to Afghanistan and the possibility of concluding a peace deal with the Taliban. Meanwhile, we kept a watchful eye on Iran and their malign behavior throughout the region. Our biggest areas of concern were their provision of ballistic missiles to the Houthis in Yemen, their arms shipments into Syria, their continued threats against Persian Gulf shipping, and the growing belligerence of the Shia militia groups in Iraq that they were supporting and directing. Though the rhetoric between Washington and Tehran had abated some, tensions were still high. While our main attention moved elsewhere, Iran's did not. At the Pentagon, we expected Trump's failure to respond to the drone shootdown would encourage increasing provocations from Tehran. Indeed, the pieces were falling into place that would eventually aggregate and escalate into a major confrontation, the most serious in decades between the United States and Iran. This first experience with the president jump-started a fast, chaotic, yet necessary learning process for me. As I would assess over time, Trump's instincts weren't always wrong about the policy or end state he wanted to achieve. However, the odds of success were spoiled or the goal tarnished by the process he often followed, little to none. The strategy he usually pursued, narrow and incomplete. The consensus he normally built behind it, minimal and insufficient. And the manner in which he generally communicated it, coarsely and divisively. In short, the ends he often sought rarely survived the ways and means he typically pursued to accomplish them. This often made all the difference. Chapter 4. Civilian Control and Reform of the Pentagon.
The vote just came in and it was 90-8. That's a vote we're not accustomed to, President Trump said as he introduced me before the nation on July 23, 2019 from the Oval Office. It was a resounding bipartisan vote, one that only three other Trump cabinet officials would receive, and they were all in 2017 when the administration was young. The president and I spoke privately later, and he said, 90-8. Huh, maybe I should be concerned?
Maybe.
The president was very generous in his remarks that afternoon. He described me as outstanding in every way and said, no one is more qualified. Trump flattered me with his comments, but I was most appreciative of the fact that Tim Kaine, my senator from Virginia and a Democrat, had introduced and vouched for me at my confirmation hearing. He gave me one of the greatest compliments anyone could by describing me as a leader of sound character and moral courage. His endorsement was a selfless act of bipartisanship that gave me real hope that there were still leaders in Congress, especially ones who could get our nation's lawmakers working together once again. As I entered the Pentagon the next day, the stir in Washington over the lack of confirmed leadership at the DOD was finally ending. There were still concerns about the relationship between the uniformed military and their civilian leadership, however. These were real, but mostly about the interactions in Washington, D.C., among the department's civilians, the armed services, and the combatant commands. The DOD has 11 combatant commands, each with a geographic, for example, European command, or functional, for example, space command, mission. They are comprised of units and personnel from the armed services and led by a four-star general or admiral who provides command and control of military forces in peace and war. Importantly, the operational chain of command runs from the president to the Secretary of Defense and then to the combatant commanders. There was never any doubt about civilians being in control, This is both a fact and a principle based in law, practice, history, and culture. It was a sacrosanct matter drilled into our military leaders from day one. Yet, I did have concerns that the combatant commands had grown too powerful. Restoring the proper civilian-military balance was an issue that I would work hard to achieve. In November 2018, the Congressionally Directed National Defense Strategy Commission published a dire warning that the security and well-being of the United States are at greater risk than at any time in decades, and that America's military superiority has eroded to a dangerous degree. After summarizing the key threats and challenges facing the United States and its armed forces, the Commission stated that healthy civilian-military relations were essential to address these matters. It then surprised many by reporting on a relative imbalance of civilian and military voices on critical issues. In its report, this bipartisan group was troubled that civilian voices were relatively muted on issues at the center of U.S. defense and national security policy. During my tenure as Army Secretary, I faced this imbalance. It was frustrating and hindered my ability as a senior civilian leader, number three in the Pentagon chain of command, no less, to perform my statutory duties. The combatant command's influence, usually backed by the uniformed joint staff, on my authority to man, train, and equip the force for deployment, to include medical preparations and who I could send abroad, were the most egregious examples. It was incredible how much authority had been whittled away from the services and their civilian leaders over the years. Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson, Navy Secretary Richard Spencer, and I had written letters to OSD leadership and raised these issues during meetings, asking for relief with specific proposals. But none ever came. The Joint Staff, advocating on behalf of the combatant commands, kept pushing the issues off or watering down the text to preserve the position and prerogatives of the four-star commanders. It wasn't until I became Defense Secretary that I could address these problems. It took some time and effort, but in December 2019, I issued my first directive effecting some of these changes to re-empower the civilian secretaries. Wilson, Spencer, and I, the three amigos as we called ourselves, worked together on other tough issues. For example, we took on an OSD medical bureaucracy that tried to leverage congressional mandates to reform the healthcare system as a way to subsume our operational medical personnel, units, and resources. We also worked together to improve acquisition programs and share workload, whether it was developing hypersonic missiles for our respective services or swapping ideas on body armor for the troops. No good idea was off the table, and no parochialism had a place on it. We were putting readiness, capability, and common sense above all else, even if it affected our budgets and missions. Some of my best times as Army Secretary were in the moments I spent working with my fellow service secretaries. Our biweekly breakfasts and after-hours get-togethers really built a strong rapport among our services and us. Beyond our individual goals, we really hoped to demonstrate the good that came to the Defense Department when the three of us worked together. Competition and rivalry often made for contentious relationships in the past between service secretaries. We aimed to change that. Another problem that Wilson, Spencer, and I faced was getting complete, accurate, and timely information about force management and operational matters. My primary source for receiving information, such as combatant commanders' requests for forces and their operational employment abroad, was through the Army Chief of Staff. General Milley attended weekly sessions in the tank, the conference room where the Joint Chiefs of Staff met, and briefed me on what was going on. He was conscientious about this, but none of this information ever came through the civilian side. In other words, I usually had to rely upon second-hand updates from my senior military advisor to learn what was happening. These matters often affected important things, such as my force, my budget, my training cycles, and my readiness. The National Defense Strategy Commission report took a similar view. When it came to issues such as operational deployments and global integration, decision-making at the Pentagon had to be nested under higher-order guidance from civilians. In the report's view, failure to give due consideration to the relevant political-military dynamics of force management shifts involved could influence readiness and produce terrible strategic results. As Army Secretary, with all my years of experience in the Army, in the Pentagon, in Congress, and in Washington, I, as well as Spencer and Wilson, could provide useful counsel, or at least be a sounding board for some of these matters. At a minimum, basic information could help me look over the horizon and prepare Army units for what may be asked of them down the road. The Commission report explicitly stated, "The issue here is not that the existing Title X responsibilities of the Secretary and his civilian advisors are inadequate, but that they have not been used effectively, and that responsibility on key strategic and policy issues has increasingly migrated to the military." How damn true. Since I wasn't involved in the process as Secretary of the Army, and I had never been invited to these forums, it was unclear to me how much OSD civilian appointees participated in the process. What I later learned was disheartening. Once I became Defense Secretary in July 2019, the first thing I did was bring together the leadership team at the top. They had balkanized over the years into roughly four groups: OSD civilians, Joint Staff, Combatant Commands, and the services. Existing Pentagon processes both reflected and exacerbated this breakdown. In my first couple of weeks as Secretary of Defense, I made immediate changes to begin getting everyone to think and function as a team. First and foremost, I made the National Defense Strategy our focus. The purpose of the NDS is to translate, refine, and develop the military guidance needed to implement the National Security Strategy that is produced by the White House. Published in January 2018, the NDS was clear-eyed and straightforward that the DoD's mission was to provide combat-credible military forces needed to deter war and protect the security of our nation, and that, if deterrence failed, the U.S. military had to fight and win on the modern battlefield. The NDS said the U.S. had now entered a new era of great power competition, with China and Russia as our strategic competitors, but that we found ourselves in a position of strategic atrophy after nearly two decades of focus on low-intensity conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had also burned down a good deal of readiness that left the force with major challenges. The strategy also said that the U.S. military operated in an increasingly complex security environment that is defined by rapid technological change. These facts, coupled with sharp funding decreases and unpredictable defense budgets during the Obama years, saw our military advantage erode as China and Russia used the same period to modernize and expand their capabilities. The fact that the People's Republic of China now has the largest navy in the world is the starkest evidence of this. At the same time, Beijing was chipping away at the international rules-based order that helped ensure security, stability, and prosperity for many countries. Its excessive and illegal claims over the South China Sea being a prime example of that. The NDS asserted, "The costs of not implementing this strategy are clear. Failure to meet our defense objectives will result in decreasing U.S. global influence, eroding cohesion among allies and partners, and reduced access to markets that will contribute to a decline in our prosperity and standard of living." The NDS prioritized three major lines of effort for the DoD to be successful. First, rebuilding readiness as we build a more lethal joint force. Second, strengthening alliances as we attract new partners. And third, reforming the department's business practices for greater performance and affordability. There were several goals listed under each line, but like many documents of this nature, phrases such as evolve innovative operational concepts, deepen interoperability, and organize for innovation were catchy and sounded good, but didn't give enough direction for one to achieve the vision set out for the department. The challenge of any sound strategy is to operationalize it. And in the case of the NDS, this meant turning these broad lines of effort and lofty goals into actionable objectives that we could define, measure, assign, and track over time. Implementation is the tough task of any strategy, and I made this my top priority. To effect this, the second major change I made was to have two large team meetings on Mondays. The first one in the morning included the OSD, the joint staff, and the service chiefs and secretaries. Rather than having a 40-minute free-for-all, we would lengthen the meeting to 90 minutes and have a more structured agenda that focused on the next 2 weeks' events and the department's priorities. Since I did this successfully as Secretary of the Army, I knew the pace, scope, and detail of the particular objectives I wanted to cover, such as readiness, modernization, reform, allies and partners, and people. Later, once we figured out our plans to implement the NDS, we added topics such as developing counter-UAS systems, digital modernization, and reveal-conceal strategies. In the end, I wanted no more than 12 topic areas so that I could revisit each priority every quarter to check on progress, while giving those implementing these initiatives the time and space to work in between updates. The last half of the meeting would include briefings by my heads of legislative affairs, public affairs, and any undersecretary on matters they wanted to raise. We then went around the room for other issues. Finally, we reviewed the dreaded task tracker. During my time as Army Secretary, the previous version of this meeting had often frustrated Wilson, Spencer, and me. When we did have substantive discussions that resulted in an action, nobody seemed to be recording and tracking these decisions. One of us would ask a month or two later, "What is the status of blank that we agreed to several weeks ago?" Blank stares would carpet the room, like we were in the Twilight Zone. So no progress was ever made, it seemed. Everybody kept doing what they wanted to do. We changed this, too. There was no escaping a tasking now, and no running from a progress report and the metrics we established for each. The other meeting added to our Mondays was an afternoon session on NDS implementation. To be successful, I needed all the right players in the room. That meant not only the service leaders and undersecretaries who participated in the morning session, but the combatant commanders as well. We set the time for 90 minutes in the middle of the day to be as fair as possible for those commanders calling in from different time zones abroad. It was this weekly forum where we discussed much of the hard work associated with reviewing war plans, developing supporting strategies, and discussing specific NDS operational issues. Unlike my experience as Secretary of the Army, the civilian secretaries would be at the table. Finally, I began meeting with the service secretaries every 2 to 3 weeks. I wanted to give them the opportunity to raise issues directly with me, for us to discuss matters that affected more than one of the services, such as housing, diversity, or COVID response, and for me to update them on any emerging operational issues. I didn't get any regular FaceTime with the Secretary of Defense when I was Secretary of the Army, but the one or two times that I did, I found it very helpful when it came to receiving guidance on major issues, feedback on something the Army was doing, or flagging an issue for Mattis or Shanahan to be aware of. The service secretaries appreciated these sessions for all these reasons, but also because it empowered them to go back to their services and speak with more authority. In my mind, this was not solely about making the building run more effectively, but also about reaffirming the principle of civilian control and improving civilian-military relations. Writing a strategy and implementing a strategy are two very different things. The DoD published the NDS in January 2018, just a few months after I arrived for my fourth tour at the Pentagon. But for our equipment modernization plans, I had no sense from my Army perch that the DoD was advancing the strategy, or that we had a plan to do so. Indeed, when the NDS Commission published its report months later in November 2018, it stated that the strategy points the department and the country in the right direction, but it does not adequately explain how we should get there. They were right. Deputy Secretary David Norquist, General Joe Dunford, Eric Chuning, my new chief of staff, and I sat down in late July 2019, right after my confirmation, to discuss the way ahead. NDS implementation was the topic. After getting 90 votes from the Senate, I felt I had a strong endorsement from Congress to pursue this end, and with the advantage of having served in the building as Army Secretary, I had sufficient perspective and a lot of ideas about how to do it. The NDS wasn't perfect, but it was very good, and I didn't want to waste time reviewing, updating, and tweaking it. There would be time for that later. The key now was to flesh these ideas and others out as quickly as possible, seek input broadly, and then finalize to implement before too much time passed. If we could make real progress over the next year, then we would have accomplished something significant. Chuning pointed out that we might have only a year or so anyway before the election cycle slowed things down. David Norquist began his career as a budget analyst for the Department of the Army after graduating from the University of Michigan. He later worked on Capitol Hill, which was where I met him, before going back to a more senior role in the DOD. In 2006, David became the CFO for the Department of Homeland Security in the Bush administration. He later joined a public accounting firm before returning to the Pentagon as the comptroller in May 2017. The Senate confirmed him as Deputy Secretary of Defense a few days after me. I had really come to know David when I was Secretary of the Army. He is incredibly smart, analytical, and thorough, with a good sense of humor and a surprising knack for communications messaging. He made a good partner and sounding board for me. I was fortunate to have Eric Chuning as my first chief of staff. I became acquainted with him while I was Army Secretary and was impressed. It was only later that I would learn he was working on Wall Street when 9/11 happened. He enlisted, went to Army Officer Candidate School, and became a military intelligence officer, serving in the famed 1st Cavalry Division in Iraq. After the Army, Eric worked for McKinsey & Company before returning to the DOD in October 2017 to be Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Industrial Policy. When Pat Shanahan became the acting secretary, he elevated Eric to the chief of staff role. I decided to hold on to Eric once the Senate confirmed me, despite some pressing me to bring in my own guy. On top of all this great experience, Eric was a serious thinker, a very good manager, and an even-keeled colleague. The first half of my tenure was not nearly as demanding as the second half, though we had our moments of high stress in different ways. I'll never forget when Eric burst into my office once after a particularly rough morning. Something wasn't going well, and I figured it was more of the same. "Can today get any worse?" I mused. To my surprise, it could. Eric's eyes widened and his voice grew anxious. "Sir," he said, "please come with me. We have an unidentified aircraft in the Washington, D.C. airspace." He added, "Northcom and others have been trying to contact it for quite some time." Next up was a nose bump, where our fighters conduct a movement in front of the aircraft to get its attention, Eric said. Failing that, more drastic measures are part of the protocol. "If it doesn't change course in the next few minutes," my chief of staff said, "you may need to give the order to shoot it down." Time was ticking away, so we hustled down to another room where a computer screen displayed a graphic of the region's airspace. I could see the unidentified plane, as well as the military aircraft and other capabilities we had available. I also had the Northcom commander on the line. I had rehearsed this scenario in my first weeks on the job, but now this was the real thing. As I heard the chatter on the open line, I prayed that we would get the pilot's attention. With little time left on the countdown clock before I would have to give the shoot-down order, the plane veered off and continued away from the White House and the Capitol. Phew. This wouldn't be the last time we'd go through this, though. We had a senior leader conference coming up in early October. This is an annual meeting where all the 4-star combatant commanders, uniformed and civilian service leaders, and OSD undersecretaries meet to discuss a variety of issues. Too often, these gatherings didn't deliver a high return on investment. In my view, if we were going to bring all the commanders to D.C. and ask other leaders to commit to a full day as well, then we should get real value out of it. With that, I decided that I would work with my policy office and my strategic initiatives group to fine-tune the National Defense Strategy implementation ideas I was developing. We would send them out a week or two in advance for the commanders to review. We could then discuss them in detail at the conference with the aim of locking them down before the day ended. The schedule would be aggressive, but we didn't have the luxury of conducting the long, tedious, drawn-out processes typical of the Pentagon. The Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, depending on administration, includes at least 6 core elements, each of which are led by a Senate-confirmed undersecretary: acquisition and sustainment, budget and financial management, intelligence and security, personnel and readiness, research and engineering, and policy. The policy office's responsibilities include national security policy formulation, coordination, and implementation, strategy, plans, and capabilities development, and homeland defense and global security, among other things. By the time the conference arrived, we had developed what would eventually become the top 10 objectives critical to implementing the NDS. I kicked off the morning session by stating my primary focus: warfighting. We couldn't afford to get this wrong, I told the group. Collective and coordinated advancement of the top 10 objectives would get us there.